So it's been a long week. We spent time with firefighters in North Georgia. We talked to music legend Stanley Clark. We learned about an Emory class that teaches future lawyers to be actors. So as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind a bit, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for The Break Room.
For the first time, the Santa bringing joy into the lives of little ones. The Santa experience inside the Mall of America is black.
People living in public housing soon won't be able to smoke in and around their residences.
When you're president, can you just offer a theory that has no evidence behind it, or does he have to tighten up his standards of proof?
Joining us in The Break Room, marketing communications specialist Tamika DePriest. We also have our good friend Sam Burnham here virtually. he curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Sam joins us by Skype. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
And also in the room with me, Ed Sohn, Global Director of Legal Managed Services for Thomson Reuters, and Kennesaw State University Psychology Professor Roxanne Donovan. Welcome all.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You made it to Friday.
Barely.
So just before the break, we talked on the show about how the U.S. Department of Education wants schools to ban corporal punishment. Many schools still do this. 22 states allow for it, including Georgia. And so the question I put to all of you guys is, should spanking, paddling in schools be banned?
Yes, I have no idea why this is still happening. When I was on internship, I worked at a school that paddled children when they behaved badly. And it was so hard to watch because I know all manner of psychological research and medical research says that this is bad, that it may work for short-term compliance, but long-term compliance, pro-social behavior, moral behavior, all that declines over time with the use of corporal
you
punishment.
You and all your science.
You know, I think that it's got to engender a sense of shame also when it's happening sort mm-hmm. of in a place that's publicly sanctioned. I totally agree, and I think it's hard for me because I've not heard the argument for paddling in school really well articulated. I know that, you know, it happens usually at the parents' request. I know that, and so maybe that can try to take the edge off of it, but it's hard for me to hear the argument very pro paddling. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
I favor a consistent no corporal punishment rule across the board. I think these models that are geared toward reinforcing positive behavior is the way to go. And I mean, not even at the school level, but just sort of across the board, there's this sort of Gallup Strengths Quest research and program where the whole concept is, you know, you take this test, you figure out your strengths from these high level thematic buckets, and then you reinforce those in your work and in your school approach rather than strengthening weaknesses.
Jeez, you guys and your evidence-based behavior. Sam, look, many conservatives very much support corporal punishment. Are you one of them?
I typically favor local control in schools, but I didn't use corporal punishment a lot with my own kids, and I don't know that I want someone else kind of taking that on their, you know, on their own to do that for my kids for me. I'm not real favorable toward it.
So across the board, listeners, if you out there are in favor of corporal punishment, let's hear your argument. You know how to reach us. But let's move on. We're talking about corporal punishment, but here's something else that happens in a lot of households.
Mom, wait, just 20 more minutes.
It's a school night, Michael.
I'm serious, Mom. The campaign took 2 weeks to plan. How was I supposed to know it was going to take 10 hours?
You've been playing for 10 hours?
So I've had many arguments with my son about late night gaming. I'm sure other people have. But a new study says, who am I to talk? Adults spend just as much time looking at their screens as teenagers do. That comes from a group called Common Sense. They focus on child development in the digital age. So, all right, who's ready to admit? Now, Ed, you don't count. Your son is what, 8 weeks old?
Yeah,
I can't imagine
son.
He's looking at his Surface tablet.
He was the only thing screen he was looking at was watching the playoffs, the Cubs winning it all with me. But I'm sure he'll remember every minute of it. But otherwise, no, not too much screen time for him.
Everybody else here, are you ready to admit you spend as much time on your screen as your kids?
Oh, I definitely do not. But not because I am this amazing person, but because I'm intentional about how much screen time I have, because I know the detriments of modeling problematic behavior and the detriments of being on the screen. So I put my phone away when I come in the house. I talk to my kids. I put it on Do Not Disturb from 8 p.m. to 7 a.m. Wow. That's not to say I may not find my way to Netflix and binge watch some things after they go to bed. But I mean, I know the problematic nature of screens.
These psychology
you should start counseling
no
others like me.
I'll send you my daily rate.
I've had no success in that. And I don't have kids, but I do babysit from time to time for family members and friends. And I am indeed a bad example. A really bad example. Now, let me say, you know, as a marketing and communications professional.
Oh, here comes the justification.
Yes, I'm raising my justification, indeed. Yes, it comes with sort of looking at screens more than I think the average person. So there.
So there. Sam, you're a blogger, so I know you're on your computer all the time.
I counted. I use 4 different screens for my, quote-unquote, real job. And then I'm using 2 screens right now, so I can't really say a lot about screen time.
I hope people are turning their screens off at least an hour before going to bed. That's
yeah,
all I
because
have to say about that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good
yes,
idea.
Yes, yes.
These scientists need to stop, ruining the party.
You know, I think that it's, my view on this, that screen time is sort of a culture, and I feel like there might be, I would make the bold prediction that sort of the next generation of screen over users.
Oh, the pendulum's going to swing.
The pendulum's going to swing. That there's, it's going to suddenly become cool to unplug. You know, it'll be like Burning Man, where like, okay, you can't do anything. You can't have a screen. You can't have a camera. This moment is ephemeral, and it's going to be because of your personal experience. I have a feeling that that's going to make a comeback somehow.
Well, you are so optimistic.
Exactly.
Well, it's good for your health.
Okay, so let's move on to something else, and let's see if you guys are willing to admit this, too. New research from AAA shows if you get only 5 or 6 hours of sleep at night, you are twice as likely to get into a car accident the next day. 1 in 5 accidents involves a drowsy driver. So going by that measure, and we're going to start with you, Sam, because you have to drive a long way to get here. How often do you think you drive on less than 7 hours of sleep?
I don't know that that happens as much now as it did when I was younger. My job has also changed somewhat. Let me tell you, if you are out at 3 o'clock in the morning and there's a fire truck behind you, that man is driving on less than 7 hours of sleep. You need to stay out of his way.
That is true. Fair enough.
So I have actually bought into getting, the proper amount of sleep. And for me, that is an average of at least 7-8 hours. And so I'm with Arianna Huffington and the whole sleep revolution. I am.
I'm not going to argue with anything that tells me to sleep more.
And I've used my Fitbit to determine my quality of sleep. And the last time I checked, I was in the high 80s percentile.
Wow.
Oh, so good for you.
Yeah, well-behaved people. Roxanne?
I'm ashamed to say that I have fallen asleep while driving once and was in an accident. A single car accident. Luckily, I was not hurt and no one else was hurt, but that was a huge wake-up call for me, and it was really humbling about how optimistic I thought I was to be behind the wheel.
So I think I had a similar experience. I think I might be able to one-up you. I was in a multi-car accident when I was very young. I was 18. I was coming back my first year from school, from finals. I had never pulled all-nighters with coffee, didn't know what finals were really like. And right after finals had ended, I was driving to meet my parents, and it was a cold day in Chicago. I had all the windows down, the radio was blaring, and but I hadn't really slept well, more than a couple hours over the last 72. And I swerved into opposing traffic. I hit a car. I think that's when I woke up. My front wheels went into the air, and I landed on top of a row of cars in a used car dealership. And, literally I was like looking into the sky, into the night sky. At the end of it, the car could not be towed off of the other cars. Like 2 hours later, they had to get a flatbed because the axle was bent. Suffice it to say, I take not driving while sleepy pretty seriously. And through those younger years, I agree with Sam. I mean, I would pull over on the side of the road and just take a nap if I ever felt like that danger was coming. That being said, I'm in the newborn son stage, and of course I'm not getting 7 hours. That's insane. That's a That's crazy. A fantasy to get 7 hours of sleep at night. Certainly I still drive. I think a lot of it comes with distance, highway hypnosis, those types of things that you definitely have to self-regulate.
We are having coffee and conversation in the break room like we do every Friday. My guests are Tamika DePriest, marketing communication specialist. Also Ed Sohn of Thomson Reuters, Kennesaw State University professor Roxanne Donovan, and via Skype, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. And you know what goes well with biscuits? Coffee. We want to thank, as we do every Friday, Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink every morning. You can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. All right. Since we're into confessing today, let's give a few more self-disclosure. Maybe we're all a little narcissistic, and maybe that's made worse by Twitter and Facebook. Let's face it, a big pot of our socializing is now done online.
If we drill down into the numbers, you have got a solid popularity arc here. What's that? 8:40 a.m. You're working hard on your socials. Most of your interactions are confined to your inner circle, and they're largely, pardon the term, mid to low range folks.
Yeah, I know a lot of mid to low range folks, I think. But research at the University of Georgia say our social media may cause us to be more narcissistic. The study says the large number of updates, online friends and followers, selfie postings can lead people to a more extroverted form of narcissism. My producers take a million selfies, including Sean Powers, who can't stop taking selfies with his cats. So whatever that means. But here we go. Do we think social media has made us all a little more narcissistic? And let's start with our psychology professor.
I think the hallmark of narcissism is not knowing that you're a narcissist. So that's a hard question to answer.
Oh, you need other people to say you're a narcissist.
So if people keep telling you they think you're a narcissist, you need to be reflective on that. But that's another hallmark of narcissism. You're not reflective. But I don't know if it's causal. It's correlational. So is it that we are using social media as an avenue to express our narcissism, or is it that it's causing?
Aren't we all have some latent narcissism? Isn't it possible that social media brings that out?
That's what I'm saying, right?
Oh, I see.
Is it just a vehicle for us to express our pre-existing narcissism? I would argue that it might be.
But at what point does it amplify it, though, right? Like, what takes what's there and then, you know, reinforces it? You know, one of my friends that does marketing actually was noting that on Snapchat, for instance, what the only real kind of feedback you get is how many people looked at it, and that's it. And that sort of fuels
that's
a type
a great
of narcissism,
point.
Right? Like, it's like I put something up there, and look at all the people that looked at it. They might not even have liked it. They might not have even finished it, but they looked at it. And it reinforces that there is something about me that has a certain level of self-importance based on what I'm, of course, self-selecting and projecting on social media.
Well, we all have an ego.
Says our marketing person.
And so I did the quiz.
Are you a narcissist?
I did one of these quizzes, and it came back, you're almost a narcissist. And so going into the quiz, I thought, absolutely not. Coming out of the quiz and thinking about it, I thought, I see how this might be a correlation.
Sam, are you so focused on social media?
Well, I didn't think so before. I was sitting there looking at my circles on social media, all these history nerds and architects and traditional kind of people. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute, listening to the three of these, I'm, you know, also counting page hits on my blog and things like that.
Yeah.
I still want to say no, but maybe I'm a political liar.
Well, since you brought it up, thanks for transitioning us there, Sam Burnham. One person who is on social media a lot is our president-elect. Here is Donald Trump speaking a few years ago with David Letterman on CBS, and they are talking about Twitter.
You think it's so cute and so smart, right. And it comes back to haunt you.
But you—that's what you kind of live there. That's where you,
I like it.
Yeah.
You know, it's literally, it's millions of people are listening or watching, and it's an amazing, powerful thing.
Okay, so it is powerful, and it's more powerful when you're the president-elect of the most powerful nation in the world. Trump recently tweeted that millions of people voted illegally during the election, and that cost him the popular vote. That's something that PolitiFact rated pants on fire. It is something that has been rated absolutely false by every fact-checking organization. So here's an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes. Scott Pelley asks Speaker of the House Paul Ryan if he believes that statement Donald Trump made on Twitter.
I don't know. I'm not really focused on these things.
Wait a minute. You have an opinion on whether millions of Americans voted
illegally? I have no way of backing that up. I have no knowledge of such things.
You don't believe that?
It doesn't matter to me. He won the election.
So Ryan went on to say there's a difference between what Donald Trump says in private and in public, and he only cares, he says, he only does not care about the private conversations, but on getting things done. But what does it matter, the truthfulness of our politicians, or in not just Donald Trump, but all of them?
Well, I've always been concerned about the truthfulness of politicians and, you know, recognizing that the communication game in politics is, you know, gray, nuanced. You know, I think of Bill Clinton. I did not have sexual relations with that woman who did not consider the technique employed as...
Keep it clean here.
As actual sex. but, you know, as one who holds an undergraduate degree in English, I'm baffled by this whole notion that you cannot take words literally, period, whether they're coming from a politician or otherwise.
Yeah, as a journalist, I back that up.
But the fact that other people are taking Trump's words seriously based on the uptick in hate violence and hate aggression means something, right? And I think this is Ryan having cognitive dissonance and twisting himself into a pretzel to bridge that gap. If I tell my 8-year-old and 10-year-old they can't lie, then I think the president needs to do the same thing that we tell our kids, like not lying, not stretching the truth, and words matter. That should be the basic message of the leader of one of the major countries in the world.
On the other hand, Sam, and we'll put this to you too, Ed, we're not surprised when the things that politicians say are not completely true, right? I mean, Donald Trump's continuing a tradition, right?
I'm not remotely surprised. I mean, being a student of history for the majority of my life, we can go back and find presidents that have said things that weren't true, that have said one thing and done another. And it's not just presidents, it's members of Congress, it's on the state and local levels. Politicians, I'm so used to politicians lying, I wait and see what they do. They can say a lot of things, but I'm going to wait and see what they actually do.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that at some level. I think that trustworthiness in politics really comes down to whether it's correlative with performance. But I think that the difference here is that, you know, to the earlier point, words matter. And there is a separate effect of somebody get with that type of exposure and that type of influence, saying things that might be incendiary or may have an effect on the way people respond. That has nothing to do with governance. It has nothing to do with performance as the president of the United States, but still has a massive impact. And I think that there's a certain level of responsibility that comes with that platform. So I think that there is something here. It's not to be totally ignored. I do understand that from a functional political perspective, like, well, does that impact whether or not they deliver on promises and whether or not that influences, you know, whether the words are representative of the actual performance? Yeah, maybe not. But the words by themselves are still words going out into kind of you know, the stratosphere, and that can have an impact on people.
If you're just joining us, we're hanging out in the break room with Tamika DePriest, Sam Burnham, Ed Sohn, and Roxanne Donovan. All right, so since we're talking presidential, one of the final policy changes of the Obama administration, we think there could be many more ahead, but so far, was announced last week. It will no longer be legal to smoke in public housing. The biggest impact will hit New York. There's 400,000 people there that live in public housing, but there's plenty here in Georgia. And I wonder, do government subsidies mean the government has a right to dictate lifestyle choices? What do we think?
So this was a challenging one for me, right? Because I think, and it's not only my thinking, but it's what the research says. Smoking is bad, particularly for children. Secondhand smoke is pretty bad. But I object to limiting the liberties of only low-income people when arguably middle and upper-income people receive greater governmental subsidies by way of tax breaks. So why is it so differentially applied, and why are the poor the ones that are being over-policed?
Sam?
Well, I see that as any organization that's receiving government subsidies, which I typically oppose in general, but when they get these subsidies, they have restrictions that go with them. If you're a nonprofit organization and you receive tax credits, or if you're a college or university that receives tax funding, there are certain guidelines that you're forced to hold after that. And I really don't have a problem with that. I would rather see our government work on economic policies that would leave people in their own homes rather than living in public policy than sort of micromanaging public housing. But with the government as the stewards of public housing, which ultimately belongs to us, the people, I feel they have a role in policing how that is regulated.
So the government played a major role in sort of this whole shift in our culture on smoking for public health reasons, the whole secondhand smoke and impact. And the government already, so in some ways, the government has already been dictating lifestyle choices. You can't smoke in federal facilities. And it's right. I mean, that has spread. You know, it's not even just the public, but also private industry. And so I take the comments of our first panelist who spoke in mind in terms of the disparity as far as approach with subsidies. But this one I support.
Yeah, you know, I want to agree that government subsidies ultimately give them some level of control. I agree that that regulation is happening, certainly tobacco tax, things like that, that all obviously go towards public policy. I do really agree that this is a regulation that's being handed down very explicitly from a position of privilege. And I think that that's troubling, not necessarily in this context, but potentially in others.
All right, so let's move on. Since we're barreling down on the holiday season, we have all known Santa. Well, you know what? Santa in many pictures smokes a pipe, since we're talking about smoking. But the most pictures of him show him that he's an older white guy, rosy cheeks, a jelly belly, that billowing white beard. But is that the only way Santa should appear? Megyn Kelly had this to say about what Santa looks like from a 2013 on Fox News.
And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white.
Okay. Larry Jefferson is an Army veteran of 25 years or so. He became the first black Santa at the Mall of America in Minnesota. Families even flew in from other states to see him. And Jefferson spoke with a CBS affiliate in Minneapolis.
It gives the kids an opportunity to see Santa that looked like them. Just Saturday, I was doing a party for an event, and one child said, Santa, you're brown. And I said, yes, I am. I says, but Santa comes in many different colors.
But look, if you're on social media, you know that people have been losing their minds. Some people have been losing their minds over this and saying Santa is and should always be white. What do we think? Roxanne has her eyes closed.
Oh,
she is
God,
like, done.
Yes, I'm doing deep breathing. Okay, so first the historical thing. Santa, by many accounts, is based on St. Nicholas, who lived in what's now southern Turkey and is supposed to have been of Moorish descent. So that means the likelihood of him being white is pretty low. He was brown skin. So if we're talking about historically, then we need to have some more hues in our Santa representation. But also, why? Why does Santa need to be white? Whether or not we consider it based on historical accuracy or that it's a total fictional character, why is it that non-white kids can't see themselves represented in these fictional characters? And I think it's right. And the fact that it's a problem reflects a greater issue in our society about who has privilege and who doesn't and who gets to create what images look like and who gets left out of that narrative.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a question of cultural ownership. I mean, Santa, like, I tell my kid who's 8 weeks old at every opportunity that there's no Santa and tell all your friends. But
he's eight weeks old.
Yeah, so I can course correct on that. That's wrong. But you know, but I will say that, like, you know, I don't really have a problem with Americanizing Santa and you know, the cultural origins, the historical origins of it. Like, if we're divorced from that now, that's okay. What I have a problem with is less what you said, which is that there's a disproportional outcry against this. And that is sort of a sign of something underneath that's more troubling, which is that the Americanization of Santa for some people means an affiliation with whiteness, which means that there's an affiliation between whiteness and Americanization. And I think that that's troubling, that there's not a more accurate representation or ownership of what is really an American myth.
This controversy reminds me also about the debate about Jesus and I think the points that have
been
made.
Meaning that Jesus was Middle Eastern and therefore brown.
Right. Apply here as well. And so, but anyway, I was reflecting back on my own childhood experiences with Santa Claus and Christmas. And, you know, to be honest with you, growing up in Detroit, I was exposed to Black Santas then. And so it also, so this conversation today made me realize just how far we have to go in terms of a society. I mean, let's look at Barbie, which now comes in
all
different
kinds of,
shades,
yeah,
skin tones, body shapes, etc. Santa can as well.
Sam?
Well, I'm, you know, going back to what Roxanne said earlier, we have this Mediterranean figure, at least, you know, Greek, if not, as she mentioned, from a Moorish descent, that was sort of adopted as this Northern European forest elf kind of guy, and through history has brought handmade toys to children that were made in his workshop by his fellow forest elves. And I thought it was great this week when you talked about the Coca-Cola ad, Santa Claus, because that's what we have now.
We talked about the Coca-Cola company beginning with their holiday ads in the 40s, basically in the 30s, helped create what we think of as Santa Claus.
Right. And so now what we see is this Santa Claus who is ready to bring store-bought toys to all the good boys and girls, you know, at the mall. And I think that there's a lot that we can say with Santa way before you get to what color he is as to, yeah, whether or not we've changed or morphed the original, what Santa Claus is supposed to be.
He's magical, so I guess he could be anything, but we are out of time in the, right, the brain. We are talking about an imaginary figure, after all.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. What are we defending here?
Yeah. I want to say thank you to all my guests, Tamika DePriest, marketing communications strategist, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Ed Sohn of Thomson Reuters, and Kennesaw State University professor Roxanne Donovan. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank
you.
Thanks
Happy
so much.
Friday.
Thank you.